Good morning, church. Wanted to remind you, a few months ago, Ron shared with us some realities about this room, and the reality is there's not enough of it. And since September's here, we'll most likely be back over 400 people in here on most Sundays. Last Sunday we had 420. I think we have just shy of 450 seats in here, so that's not very many empty seats available, especially if somebody comes in here with three or four or more people as a family and they're trying to find. I mean, even this morning, we don't have that many people here compared to last week, but I don't see five seats together anywhere, which is not an abnormally sized family. You know, if they walked in, they wouldn't be able to find seats together. So we have an experiment brewing, which Ron briefly mentioned, and it's just around the corner. And so I wanted to give you a little more heads up on that. It's called Life Group Worship. And the intent is to free up 30 to 40 seats in this room by hosting one or two life groups in the Gathering Place classroom during this time. The Gathering Place classroom is at the back end of the new part of the building, behind the partition. And here's how we hope this works. One or two life groups will be identified each week to participate in life group worship, and you'll come to the Gathering Place classroom instead of in here at 10:30. And you'll bring your children with you if you have those little people around you, and they will still go to Kids Own Worship on the same schedule. They'll come by and pick them up in there, but they'll be returned to you also in that classroom. So they'll be picked up and returned in that same place. And each week, a different life group will be selected to participate in life group worship. Your leader will send you an email with details when it's your time. We'll publish it in expressions. We'll hopefully have it on the screen as well as the weeks progress. But this life group worship experiment, keyword experiment, will hopefully allow us to do some things and have conversations and share some experiences in ways that we can't do in this room with 400 people. And so our first go at this will have a focus on communion. So when you come in, when it's your time, if you're in a life group and you're set for this week, you'll walk in the door and we'll have tables set up for you to sit around, and we'll guide you through some thoughtful conversation around your table, and we'll conclude with communion together. So, you know, it'll be simple, it will be encouraging, and when we're kind of close to finished, your children will be returned to you there. So stay tuned to see when your life group is scheduled. I believe it's something that will energize you. That's something I don't think you'll want to miss. We'll be starting on September 15th. So I don't know. We haven't decided who's in on that week, but every life group will go through this one time. And then when we're through them all, we'll regroup and we'll have a different life group worship experience, you know, established for the next time around. We plan to do this two times this fall semester and two times in the spring semester. Does that sound okay? All right. I think you'll enjoy it. We did a little practice run through on Wednesday, and it went okay. We had to change a few things around, but that was a good experience for the staff to go through with some of you out here that helped us out with that. We appreciate that. Okay, this is my last parable to talk about for a few weeks. Barrett's going to be back on focusing on the Lord's Supper for six weeks, somewhere in there, which is kind of ties in with our life group worship emphasis too. So this morning we'll finish up one more parable. I've been doing a little research recently on this idea of commitment, which is what this parable that we're going to look at is about today. And I ran across this story, which was, I don't think I knew this. I probably heard this when I was in elementary school or middle school or somewhere in history that I forgot. But there's this dude in 1519 named Hernando Cortez, and he set sail from Cuba to the Yucatan Peninsula, and he had 11 ships, 500 soldiers, 100 sailors, and 16 horses. And his mission was to seize the world's richest treasure, which had been held by the same army for over 600 years. And a lot of other people had tried, and every one of them had failed. But Cortez thought he had a different approach. He gathered an army who were committed beyond the level of the common man, in his mind at least, and he had an intense interview with every single person on this mission. And he asked them what their lives would be like when they took possession of the treasure. He asked them how their families and their future generations would be different if they took hold of this treasure, and he sold the crew on this mission. And so they set sail from Cuba. And about halfway through the voyage, many of the soldiers and the sailors who were once all about this, they were suddenly transformed into first-class whiners. You know, it's like the kids in the back seat of the car on a long trip. "Mr. Cortez, we're not sure this is where we want to be. How much longer? You know, we're not sold that this is such a good idea. This isn't what we expected this to be like." But when they arrived at their destination, he gathered them on the beach, and he gave this order: "Burn the boats." He looked at them, he gathered them up, he said, "Torch the ships. If we go home, we're going home in their boats." And so that's what they did. And an amazing thing happened. They fought really well. And they seized that 600-year-old treasure. So you could say they were all in on this. So today we're going to take a look at a couple of parables in Luke 14. If you have your Bible open, you're going to see a heading most likely above that section of the text, and it's called "The Cost of Being a Disciple." And the first thing I'd like you to notice is the environment leading into these parables in verse 25. What we have as an intro to this section is these words: large crowds were traveling with Jesus. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus. I wonder why did he... This is maybe a stupid question, but why were there always large crowds around him? And, there's several answers. One may be because he performed some really cool magic tricks, you know, from time to time. He was a really good storyteller, as you can see from these parables. And he was on their side when he would slam the enemy, you know, the Pharisees. They kind of like that. So on the surface, you know, you think, who could resist following him around? But if you look at Jesus' ministry a little deeper than surface level, you'll discover that he had zero interest in generating big numbers, which is fascinating to me. In John 6, he does a similar thing that he does here in Luke 14. The crowds are growing, and he decides to lay out some really difficult teaching. In John 6, verse 60, this is what one of these interactions that he has with the disciples. He says, on hearing this, this tough teaching, many of the disciples said, "This is hard teaching. Who can accept it?" That's the teaching about eating the body of Christ and drinking his blood is what's going on in John 6. I mean, it's really difficult teaching to absorb. And so in John 6, 66, which is ironic, you read these words: "From this time on, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him." You see, what we discover is Jesus' message thins the ranks. And you get the idea that the same thing happens here in Luke 14 as well. The message he presents in both John 6 and Luke 14 is a message of commitment. And I wonder sometimes if we're not satisfied with a veneer of Christianity rather than a deeply anchored, leave it all behind, burn the boats kind of relationship with Jesus. I wonder if we're more interested in looking religious than we are in living holy lives, because being different in our culture is costly. Blending in with the majority is much more satisfying. Mediocrity is a strong magnet that pulls every one of us down every single day. In a day when people regularly move from one company to another, one city to another, one house to another, one husband or wife to another, one truth to another, the idea of commitment is just about extinct. And yet commitment is what Jesus calls us to. In the parables, Jesus keeps laying out principles which only make sense in his kingdom. Kingdom principles are hard to follow. Man, they thin out the crowds. They make us squirm in our seats. And without a solid commitment in our heart, kingdom principles will seldom be modeled in our lives. So three times in this text we're going to look at, Jesus makes a proclamation to ward off the pretenders. Three times he speaks of commitment and follows with the words, "You cannot be my disciple." Verse 26, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his mother and father, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Jesus says commitment to me will cost you personal relationships. When any competition arises between Jesus and any other person, whether they're parents, a husband, a wife, children, friends, your boss, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, Jesus better come out on top. Being different is costly, even when you're doing the right thing. And that last line in verse 26 is kind of hard to to swallow. If anyone does not come to me, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his, even his own life. And you tie that in verse 27. Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me, they cannot be my disciple. I mean, Jesus says to us very clearly, commitment to me will require self-denial. And self-denial is certainly, it's an alien concept in our culture today. You know, let's think of a few things which we're much more familiar with than we are with self-denial, like revenge, lawsuits, MasterCard, jealousy and competition, materialism, judging others. You know, one job that Mary and I had as parents that really overwhelmed me, it was probably near the top of the list, was training Zach and Jenna to deny self. Because I knew that to train them, I had to model it. And so modeling self-denial for them to see was a challenge. And that task was intimidating, to be honest. Surrendering personal goals and desires to Jesus' authority penetrates deeply into our nature. Saying no to self and yes to God drives many people away from Christianity. And this phrase, carry his cross, is one that you and I, we've heard this talked about often. I don't believe we can overdo it. For Jesus' audience, anyone carrying a cross was on his way to die. And that's the only thing they would have thought. A cross to them would never have meant a cranky mother-in-law or a leaky roof or a dead-end job. A cross had nothing to do with long-term problems or misfortunes. The thought of condemned criminals hanging on a cross by a roadside is what they would have thought. They understood Jesus was calling them to die for him. And they knew he was asking them to make the ultimate sacrifice. So it's no surprise the crowds thinned a bit. Let's look at these two parables. Verse 28 is the first one. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this fellow began to build and was not able to finish. I mean, who hasn't had this experience? You've started something and you didn't finish it because you ran out of money or you ran out of time or you ran out of energy or passion. It might be a stack of books on your nightstand all sitting there bookmarked in about chapter, what, 3, you know? Or maybe it's the beginning of a personal budget. You've got the categories, but it's still kind of waiting to be filled in. Or maybe it's a sparsely funded retirement account or a college fund, or you know, other expenses seem to keep interfering with your attention. Or how about a half-finished basement? You know, it's been that way for, well, since you moved in. And you started strong, but you just ran out. You ran out of whatever it's taken to finish it. Verse 31, here's the other parable. Suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he's able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000. If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. This would be similar in a couple of months when Transy comes to Rupp for a basketball game. I mean, what is a coach's pregame speech like, you know, in that situation? Try to imagine that. It's like, boys, the score is tied right now. Enjoy it. And no, this game's going to fund the rest of our season, you know? Really, what are you going to say? What are you going to say in that time? In verse 33, Jesus says, in the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Jesus is telling me committed people won't be possessed by their possessions. I like this thought from Charles Swindoll in his book, Beyond the Level of Mediocrity. He says, people who are committed live with shallow tent pegs. They may own things, but nothing owns them. They have come to terms with merchandise that has a price tag and opted for commitment to values that are priceless. I like that phrase, shallow tent pegs. It helps me think about how I don't need to be tied to stuff. It's so easy for things to come between us and Jesus, and we don't even see it. The time we used to spend in private worship has so slowly been reallocated to time on the internet. Or the family time we used to spend in the evenings has been shifted to overtime hours at work to pay for a new home or a second new car. And maybe the credit card debt has eaten away any kind of cushion that we have in our budget. You can't follow Jesus where he's headed with you if you're unwilling to let go of your stuff. And by the way, threw a little challenge out to you who are over 50 last week. Did you throw something away? You know, I had a couple of people tell me about that. Dana Robinson mentioned to me that there's a word for this. It's called the Swedish death cleansing. I didn't know that. It's like Swedish death cleansing. And the idea is to declutter your life so that your death won't be a burden to people who you've left behind. That's pretty good. The fishermen Jesus called learned if they didn't leave their nets behind, they would get tangled up in them. There are a couple of directions. I thought a lot. This was, of all these parables that I've worked through here this season, this last month, this has been the most difficult one for me to kind of put together for you this morning, because I thought about all these different directions I could go. I could head down a road and talk about how difficult following Jesus is and what you have to give up and how you have to give in and how you'd better count the cost so you don't end up being a quitter. That didn't seem very inspiring to me, you know. I could have referenced the thought in Hebrews 6 that the writer of Hebrews says it's impossible for those who have fallen away after tasting the heavenly gift to be brought back. I mean, there's a cost element to that, but that didn't seem very inspiring either. So that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to try something a little bit different. So my prayer has been that this morning will be an encouragement to someone here whose life hasn't turned out the way they expected. Jesus' parable is about what it costs to follow him. And here's what seems to be true. When we're at our lowest and weakest moment, God invites us to hand him all we have. He invites us to fully trust him, to place our absolute confidence in him, and that's the cost. So let's focus for a bit on moments or seasons in life when simply getting through the day is a difficult challenge. On Monday, August 19th, our church office received news of four people who had died before the day was over. People who are connected to some of you in this room. And it doesn't matter how someone dies, nor what age they die. If you love them, it's hard. And when you receive news about your health, which you dreaded hearing, it's always hard. And when you've blown it and the consequences of your decision are blowing back onto you, that's hard to endure. When you run out of money before you run out of month, that's a hard place to be. It's hard to explain that to your kids. And when the relationship crumbles, what you thought might be the one, man, that's hard to sort out. And let's be honest about this. Not every story has a happy ending. We can't just rewind our lives. We sometimes don't get a do-over. We don't get to play the country song backwards and get our dog back and our truck back and our bike back and our boat back and our hair back, you know. Some things break which can't be repaired. So my question is, what does following Jesus cost us in these kind of seasons? And I believe what we see in our Bibles and what many of us could attest to in our lives is that God is faithful to give us the grace that we need in our season of deepest desperation. God gives us grace for each moment of grief and frustration. He gives us grace for each moment of sorrow and agony. This grace he gives us is specific, it's timely, and it's personal. It's the kind of grace God gives you when you receive a message which changes your life forever. It's the kind of grace God gives you the day after you say goodbye to someone you've spent most of your life with. And those of us who are married, half of us will experience that at some point, and it won't be easy. And some of you in here already have experienced and you understand that reality. You experience this grace when you try to hold it together, and you experience when you fall apart. You know this grace when all you can do is to be still and acknowledge who God is. I read a paragraph by Louis Giglio focused on this kind of grace that I wanted to share with you. I think it's pretty insightful. There's a new grace for you when your child doesn't live. There's a new grace for you when your father dies. There's a new grace for you on the first Father's Day after your father dies. There's a new grace for you when you know what's lost isn't coming back. There's a new grace for you when what was dreamed is never going to come to pass. There's a new grace for you when what was hoped for isn't going to be seen. This is not a grace that promises you everything is going to work out for you as you hoped. This is not a grace that offers you any guarantees except one. This grace is seldom fully understood. This grace can hardly be articulated even when it's felt. This grace is nothing you need to produce on your own. This grace is what God gives you when you have nothing left. This grace is the only hope of the moment, the hope of Christ today, the grace that Jesus is enough. So I want to set aside Luke 14 for a few minutes and move back into your Old Testament to 1 Kings 17 and pick up on an event that happened back then. In 1 Kings 17, Elijah, one of God's prophets, is on a journey with God. And this journey takes him to some very lonely places. It seems like following God has cost him greatly on some days. At this point in his life where we're going to pick up, Elijah has received this message from God. He says, the dew and the rain is going to dry up for the next several years. Chapter 17, verse 2. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook I have ordered, and I have ordered the ravens to feed you there. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth Ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. So here's the scene. We find Elijah camped out in the Kereth Ravine getting his water from a brook and his bread and meat from the ravens. One source you could say is natural, the brook, and the other source seems to be somewhat supernatural. I don't know if any of us have had food brought to us by ravens before. But I'm guessing Elijah didn't have any idea what was going to happen as he headed out toward this ravine. But here he is, receiving the grace of God in a way in which he never expected. And I wonder what Elijah thought as that creek began to get a little shallower and shallower each day. Do you suppose he had a measuring stick that he might have put marks on to watch the depth drop a little at a time? Did he do the math? That would be a good word problem. If a brook is 4 foot deep and drops 1.8 inches per day, how long till I dehydrate? You know? That's what I would have done if I were Elijah. So at some point, the brook did dry up and the birds were nowhere to be found. So it was time for God's grace to take on a different look for Elijah. And God told Elijah to go to the town of Zarephath. And he would meet a widow there who would take care of him. Now, this widow doesn't seem like a person who could take care of any additional people. She appears to be very poor. She had a son. They were just about out of food themselves. God did not send Elijah to a wealthy benefactor. He didn't find a sugar daddy for Elijah. She certainly wasn't well-connected where he sent him. He didn't send him to the guy we met last week who just built some bigger barns. He sent Elijah to find grace in the home of the last person you think would be able to help. And that makes me remember something about God. How does the song go? The first verse, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. You know, think back over your life and recall those moments when God has given you hope, he's reminded you of his presence, he's offered you another chance, and he did that in a way that you never saw coming. You only recognized it as God's sovereignty and his love as you looked at it in your rearview mirror. God doesn't look at all the wealth in the world as the answer to our problems. He looks in unexpected places. He looks at a widow. He looks at a boy with a few fish in a lunchbox. He looks at a fish with a few coins in his mouth. He looks at a bush that's on fire or a crystal clear dream. He looks at an army armed with trumpets, pitchers, and torches instead of swords and spears. He looks at a young boy with a sling. God sees great value in the weak, in the meek, in the powerless, the forgotten, the unlikely. And he invites them to be part of his grand story. So Elijah makes his way to Zarephath, and when he gets there, he meets the preordained widow by the town gate, and he asks for a little water in a jar and a small piece of bread. And she says, in essence, why not? All I have left is a handful of flour and a spoonful of oil. I'm headed home with these sticks to bake my last meal for me and my son. You might as well join us. We're all going to die soon enough. Maybe you've been at a place like where this widow is right now. Desperate and hopeless and near the end, hanging by a thread. What do you think about God asking for something from you when you're at your lowest? You know, he's inviting this woman to give up part of her last meal. And do you know what that meal represents? It represents our full trust. When we're at our weakest, when our dreams have no pulse left, when our hopes have taken their last breath, when our heart is beating on borrowed time, God invites us to give him whatever is left, which is all we have. And in giving him the little which is left, we place our full confidence in him. Listen to what Elijah says next. This is pretty cool. Elijah said to this woman, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you've said. But first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord God of Israel says." This is really cool. "The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land." I think about this often as I fill my Yukon up with 20 gallons of gas. Wouldn't it be cool? If I got that same message from God, "Kevin, that Yukon, it'll never run empty," you know? She gave all she had and ended up with so much more. And that's the way math works in God's economy. You start with a little, you give it all away, and you end up with more. Now, that math is kind of hard to follow, isn't it? Because it's not like our math. We worry that if we give our little away, what do we have left? Nada. Zip. And we don't want to give our little bit away. We're hesitant to go all in. Someone may say, "I want to follow Jesus, but will I have to give up this? Will I have to stop doing that?" I mean, that's what this parable is about. It's about counting those kind of costs. And even if we've been a Christ follower for years, we still face the need to count the cost of being a disciple. Of course, there are things we need to give up. And the list is long, isn't it? Man, it's long. And if you don't think it's long, just ask your spouse if you need some suggestions. Or ask your best, honest friend. The process of becoming holy through the transformative power of the gospel is called sanctification. It's the process of becoming like Jesus, and it's our life's work, which we'll ultimately realize in this next life. There's a verse tucked away in 1 John 3, I believe it's 2. It says, "When we see him, we'll be made like him." That's a beautiful thought. But the cost of the process is great. And I want you to hear this. I'm about finished, and so I've saved the most important thing I want you to hear for last. Sometimes I think we may be more interested in negotiating the cost of following Jesus instead of counting the cost. We may be willing to give up things, but we may not be willing to give up the right to determine what those things are. Let me run that by you again. We may be willing to give up things, but we may not be willing to give up the right to determine what those things are. We're constantly assessing a cost-benefit analysis on various kinds of behavior, which essentially keeps us in charge and not God. We say, "He can have all of me except what I do when no one is looking. He can have all of me except the nights my girlfriend and I spend together. He can have all of me except when it comes to talking about other people. He can have all of me, but I'm not going to change my lifestyle. He can have all of me, but I'm not going to change my spending habits. He can have all of me, but I'm not going to change the way I think about those people." So here's the question. What are you not willing to change? When are you more focused on negotiating rather than counting and being all in? See, this parable is about reaching a point where we say to God, "I don't know what you're going to ask of me, but I'll do whatever you say in your word, whether I like it or not. And I'll accept whatever you send into my life, whether I understand it or not." We don't get to decide that. The cost is all we have. The cost is all we are. And Jesus asks us in these parables, "Are you all in? Have you burned the boats? Is Jesus enough for you?" This morning, if you have some questions, you know, you'd like to talk to someone about what this journey with Jesus is all about, we would love to have that conversation. There'll be some people in the back, or you can come up front, and we can chat up here if you'd like, but give that some thought together as we stand and sing.